The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of the LLM Board and the Human Rights Academy, it's my pleasure to welcome you to this panel on the World Bank's legal approach and policies towards the Millennium Development Goals. I can say that on behalf of the International Legal Studies Program, it's a great pleasure for us to see this panel organized and to see so many of you attending this. One of our goals in International Week is to, we have two major goals. One is to promote integration and interaction between LLM and JD students. And we hope, and I can see that they're both LLM and JD students here, and so hopefully this discussion can promote more interaction between both groups of students. But the other goal, and maybe in the long run, the more important one, is to increase awareness in the law school community about important international law issues. And I think there's no issue more important than the question of poverty and how do we deal with the alleviation of particularly extreme poverty, which of course leads to a discussion and thinking about the Millennium Development Goals and the role that important international organizations like the World Bank play in that. So to have a panel like this today that tries to explore those issues and to think about them, both in general as well as from a legal perspective, is a wonderful addition to International Week, and so I want to thank the Academy and the LLM Board for taking this initiative and organizing this event. My job is the easiest job of all, it's just to thank everyone, and so I've executed my responsibilities, and my last responsibility is to introduce you to Professor Claudia Martin, who's the co-director of the Human Rights Academy, to say a few words. So, Claudia.
Thank you, Danny. I'm just here to, on behalf of the Academy of Human Rights and Humanitarian Law, to welcome all here. We are very happy to see that the topic has attracted such a big audience, so we were very convinced that it was a very interesting topic to debate, and an intersection between human rights and development law. So we are very happy that we were able to attract you to come here. I would like to say a few words about the Academy before I move on to the presentation of today, the panelists today. Our Academy was created to promote human rights and strengthen links with other organizations around the world, and mainly to teach and develop a specialized work in human rights. The Academy has two very important programs, an international MUCOR competition on human rights that takes place every year. The MUCOR competition is based on the Inter-American Human Rights Systems, and we also have a summer specialized program that offers 17 classes every summer here at the law school. You will be hearing about the classes and the professors that will come next year, so we wanted to encourage you to look at our programs and also to sign up to volunteer. We're always looking for volunteers and people to help in everything that we do. We have a few brochures out there. If you want to take one and look closely to what we are doing, we'll be happy, very happy to work with you in the future. I also want to thank the LLM Board. It's a great opportunity for us to work with the LLMs here at WCL. I was myself an LLM student a long time ago, so I'm not going to tell you when. And so it's always a pleasure to continue to be related to the program here. And before moving on, I want to thank the staff of the Academy. They put a lot of work to organize this panel as well. I want to thank Raquel Salinas and Vladislav, who is playing a double role here. They work very hard to make sure that the speakers are here and that you are well served. So thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy the panel. And now I would like to introduce the President of the LLM Board.
So good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. We are very pleased to have you here today. Thank you to the Academy for co-hosting this event. Before I turn it over to our great panelists, I would like to introduce to you our first panelist, Ruxandra Burdescu. We're extremely thankful for being here today. She's been extremely helpful in in developing this idea and this topic, and we went to see her, and she was really, really helpful. So thank you for being here today. Sandra Burdescu joined the World Bank 6 years ago, and since she worked in several areas, including Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, and Eastern Europe, and her main focus was on governance and regional integration. She holds a Juris Doctor degree and a PhD in comparative law from the University of Craiova in Romania. In Romania, she practices as an attorney and taught several classes, both at law school and the School of Economics. She graduated in 2002 from this program, the WCL LLM program, and as a Fulbright scholar and recipient of the Outstanding Award. So she was a brilliant student here with us. She's currently pursuing her second PhD in International Economic Law with Professor Bradlow. And she's author and co-author of several books and articles published in Romania, Luxembourg, and the US on different legal subjects, including international economic law and development. So welcome, and thank you very much for being here today.
And especially the Academy and the LLM Board for inviting me and putting together this event. I think this is an extraordinary effort, and as an alumni myself, remembering the days I've been I've spent here, this is one of the things probably I enjoyed most, being able to listen to very interesting discussions on very exciting subjects of international law. Until very late yesterday, I wasn't sure whether I come here to speak to you as an alumni, as a World Bank staff, or as Luca and Dino's mom. Luca and Dino are my toddlers. Very late in the day, my clearances came through, so yes, I can speak to you today as a World Bank staff. Probably it's not going to be as exciting as the stories I would have shared with you about my toddlers, but it is about a subject of utmost importance. And it is World Bank Group's mission to work for a world free of poverty. And I think, in my opinion, it's probably the most noble of all goals. I'm going to discuss a little bit about the global development context and some of the challenges in numbers. The poorest fifth account for 3% of world expenditures, while the richest fifth, 75%. The developed countries spend $1.2 trillion a year on defense. For the first time in history, governments have the power to wipe out poverty, but the spending by rich countries is skewed. They spend more than 7 times on arms and wars, and nearly 3 times more on agricultural subsidies than on overseas development assistance. In terms of population growth, nearly 30 times more people are being born in poor than in rich countries, meaning that this is a ticking bomb. We are not prepared to offer jobs to all those young people. And issues of immigration, diseases, poverty, fuel, terrorism will become worse unless immediate action is being taken. Half of the world's population is under 25. The global imbalance is especially noticeable with improved connectivity in today's world. For the first time in history, in 2000, all the governments and major development institutions, UN agencies, multilateral development banks, came together to face global poverty straight on. They came up with a minimum set of goals, the Millennium Development Goals, to be achieved in 15 years or 2015. Never before has the entire development community come together around a common agenda. These 8 targets would help most people meet their basic needs and cut world poverty by half. Perhaps the most interesting or unexpected goal is the number 7, which brings the environment on the development agenda, and with today's issues around global warming, disasters, these issues have never been so important. I want to share with you some good news. We are meeting the goals, or we are going to reach them. Well, in terms of the Millennium Development Goal number 1, which is to halve poverty by 2015, we are actually on track. If you look at the red line, that is what it is being expected, and if you look at the green line up to year 2000, I think, on that graph, you see that it's following the trend that we were hoping. But while this is good news, it's mostly because of countries like China and India. To reduce poverty in China, poverty dropped by 7 percentage points in the 1990s and is expected to drop by another 8 percentage points by 2015. In 1999, almost 1.2 billion people, more than one person out of every 5, had to live for less than $1 a day. This is expected to drop to around 15% by 2015, with biggest gains being led by India and China again, and also relatively high growth in East Asia and Pacific. In Africa, however, poverty rates actually have increased, and these are the bad news. Some regions of the world are actually left behind. Sub-Saharan Africa, the trend is actually getting worse in some countries due to the structural poverty, stagnant economies, armed conflict, diseases, HIV/AIDS, malaria, and natural disasters, floods, droughts. Almost half the population in sub-Saharan Africa lives below $1 a day. World Bank plays a strategic role in sub-Saharan Africa through the loans and grants it advances, where many other lenders will simply not lend. Financial commitments by the World Bank Group to Africa increased by $1.8 billion in fiscal year 2007 total, including a record $5.8 billion in IDA credits, grants, and guarantees. Even countries that have progressed, like China and India, still experience large pockets of poverty. In China, inland provinces have poverty rates ranging upwards of 40%, while the coastal provinces have negligible levels. In gender, the differences between boys and girls' rates in schooling are greatest in regions with the lowest primary school completion rates. In sub-Saharan Africa, again, the ratio of girls and boys in primary and secondary enrollments has barely changed since 1990, and are the lowest at 80%. In South Asia, progress has been greater, but girls' enrollment reached only 78% of boys in 1998. On child mortality, no region except possibly Latin America and the Caribbean is on track to achieve this goal. Progress has been particularly slow in sub-Saharan Africa, where civil disturbances, HIV/AIDS, have driven up rates of infant and child mortality. Maternal mortality. Only 58% of women in developing countries give birth with the assistance of trained midwife or doctor. In Latin America, where the share of births attended by skilled health personnel is high, the maternal mortality is low. In sub-Saharan Africa, you would understand that this is not the case. Available data suggests that we are far from meeting this goal by 2015. HIV/AIDS. In Africa, the spread of the disease has reversed decades of improvements in life expectancy, leaving millions of children orphaned. It is draining the supply of teachers and eroding the quality of education. There were almost 1 million new cases in South and East Asia
where more than 7 million people now live with HIV/AIDS. Current projections suggest that by 2010, 45 million people in low and middle income countries will become infected. Water and sanitation. In 1990, diarrhea led to 3 million deaths, 85% of them being among children. In 2000, 1.2 billion men and women still lacked access to an improved water source, 40% of them in East Asia and Pacific, 25% in sub-Saharan Africa. Many of you might be already very familiar with the Bretton Woods institutions, the sister institutions, World Bank, IMF. For those of you who are not, the World Bank, in 1942, the American and the British governments, and you can see, I love the fact that they actually, in this presentation, you can see the picture, were planning innovations that would prevent the international economy from shrinking back into the morass of the 1930s once World War II was over. The World Bank and IMF were established during the final days of the Second World War. They were created in tandem with the United Nations, who has in its mandate to address peace and security issues, and which was seen as the political space where countries could dialogue and negotiate their way through problems and hopefully avoid another world war. Since many of the economists, historians, and world leaders at that time felt that trade wars, Great Depression, and currency imbalances had been a contributing cause to the Second World War, they decided to create two sister institutions to help regulate the global economy and reconstruct Europe. France was World Bank's first borrower and the first country to graduate. In the pictures, you can see different projects supported by the World Bank, a mine in Chile, a bullet train in Japan, or a nuclear power plant in Italy. World Bank formally began operations in 1946. Recent graduates are Hungary and Latvia in 2007, Czech Republic in 2005, Slovenia in 2004. World Bank Group includes several bank agencies, International Center, from your left to right, International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes, the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Agency, IFC that deals with private sector, and IDA and IBRD. IBRD provides bank loans to middle-income countries. The definition, the World Bank definition for middle-income countries is that the per capita income in those countries ranges between $1,506 and $5,445. When the per capita income is below $1,506, the country can get a blend of IBRD money and IDA. In the last years, the following borrowers that have graduated include Korea in 94, Portugal in 89, Japan in 67, Israel 75, France in 47. IDA provides bank credits versus loans to low-income countries. Zero interest loans over 30 years with a 10-year grace period. The eligibility is anywhere below the $1,506 per capita income and can go as low as to countries that have a per capita income of only $925. Today, there are 80 countries that are eligible to receive IDA credits that account for 3.3 billion people, 80% of the population in developing world. 41 of the IDA countries are in sub-Saharan Africa, most people in Asia. About 1.2 billion of people in IDA countries live on less than $1 a day.
the most recent cases of countries graduating from AIDA and that can borrow now money on IBRD terms are Chile and Philippines. Where does the money come from? A lot of people want to know. Actually, the World Bank borrows the money it lends. IBRD is raising money on capital markets due to its preferred status and AAA credit rating, and it can lend money to middle-income countries at a preferential rate. AIDA credits are funded as following: 8.9 billion from IBRD profits and repayments, and 11.6 billion new funding from donors, a total of $20.5 billion. So AIDA is funded as about 40% from IBRD profits, so the more we are doing business with the middle-income countries and they are borrowing from the World Bank, the more we can actually put money in the AIDA basket. And at about 60% new funding from donors through three-year replenishments. The largest AIDA donors are the US, the United Kingdom, Germany, Japan, France, Italy, and Canada. Here are some facts on AIDA and how the World Bank operates. From a legal perspective, we have the Board of Governors that consists of a governor and alternate governor appointed by each member country, which meets annually and whose responsibilities include admission and suspension of members, changes in capital stock, agreements with other international organizations, or distribution of net income. Then we have the executive directors, a total of 24 that work at the bank. We have a resident board. They approve all bank projects and policies, administrative budget, etc. And they represent the governance of the 185 member countries. You can think about the World Bank as a giant cooperative of shareholders. We have 185 member countries today. East Timor, for example, joined in 2002 and the Republic of Montenegro in 2007. And here is a graph where you can see the eight largest donors that have the most voting shares: US, Japan, Germany, France, UK, China, Saudi Arabia, Russian Federation. And here is the organizational structure. I would draw your attention especially to the second line, where the inspection panel and the independent evaluation group, IEG, are acting as sort of accountability mechanisms within the institution. There are a lot of articles written on that subject if you are interested of what exactly they are doing. Here's a map where you can see where the bank works today. And here are the bank networks. Today, we are 10,000 staff, 7,000 at the headquarters and 3,000 in the field, but we are undergoing a very aggressive decentralization process. And these numbers do not count about 30,000 people that work temporary with the bank as consultants. I'm just going to, since I'm running out of time, I'm going to talk a little bit about the evolving development paradigm and the strategy today. In the 1960s, McNamara introduced a focus on poverty reduction and priority on rural development. In the 1970s, the focus was on access of poor to education, health, and social protection. In the 1980s, with the onset of the oil crisis in the 1974 and uncontrolled growth of developing country debt, bank introduced an emphasis on structural adjustment loans. I'm sure you must have read about those. In the 1990s, with the arrival of Wolfensohn in 1995, bank's agenda clearly focused on poverty reduction and new emphasis on social aspects of development. And we credit President Wolfensohn with the fact that for the first time, he put corruption on the developmental agenda. Corruption used to be a taboo in the World Bank. People were even afraid of pronouncing this name. People were referring to it as the C word. And it was President Wolfensohn who for the first time said that unless we tackle corruption, we cannot talk about development and its efficiency. in the 2000s, as in the aftermath, the bank strongly emphasized the importance of governance and anti-corruption, and we now finance anti-corruption projects, train the judiciary systems, strengthen the media and the rule of law, and you would not have probably one single strategy document or one important World Bank document that would not have a specific strategy or would not tackle the corruption situation in a particular country. Today, what is the fashion of the day? It's called sustainable and inclusive globalization. Globalization has become clearly the defining mark of our time. And in addition to its many challenges, to its many benefits, there are enormous challenges. A lot of people are left behind. Many remain on the fringes, and some are falling further behind. Exclusion, grinding poverty, and environmental damage create a lot of dangers. And the ones that suffer most are those who have the least to start with. Indigenous people, women, and rural poor, Africans, and their children. This is a quote from our president. And last but not least, these are today's six strategic themes. I don't have too much time, so I'm not going to talk about this. If there are questions, I would be happy to take your questions. Some of our approaches and instruments include the debt relief initiative, safeguards, poverty reduction strategies, community-driven development. Let me just talk for 1 minute about the debt relief. At their July 2005 summit in Gleneagles, the leaders of the G8 nations proposed 100% cancellation of debt owed to IDA, the IMF, and the African Development Fund by some of the world's poorest countries, most of them in Africa and Latin America. The new debt relief plan, called the Multilateral Debt Relief Initiative, MDRI, was endorsed by the Bank Fund Development Committee in September 2005 at the annual meetings. Relief under the plan is provided in support of government efforts to tackle poverty and is an extension of debt relief available under the Enhanced Heavily Indebted Poor Countries Initiative. Some of our products include investment loans or credits, development policy lending, guarantees, or non-lending products such as learning analytical work, capacity building, advisory services. What does the bank do today? We have two strategic directions: the building the climate for investment, jobs, and sustainable economic growth, and investing in and empowering poor people to participate in development. In fiscal year 2007, we committed $34.3 billion in loans, grants, equity investments, and guarantees to our members and to private businesses in member countries. We are playing a strategic role in sub-Saharan Africa through the loans and grants we are advancing. And business is growing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Alexandra. I'll now like to turn it to Professor Levinson. I think most of you know him, but I'd still like to introduce him. It took Professor Levinson about 30 seconds to accept our invitation, so we're delighted to have it here, to have him here today with us. Professor Levinson is a distinguished lawyer in residence. He has an extensive experience on the ground, which includes the position of General Counsel at the Inter-American Development Bank. Professor Levinson is specialized in foreign direct investment issues and is fluent in Spanish and Portuguese. Professor Levinson is well known for his knowledge of international financial issues and workers' rights. He is currently teaching three classes: legal aspect of foreign direct investment, issues in international trade and international financial institution. And he has recently published a book, which I recommend you to read, Who Makes United States Foreign Policy? So thank you, Professor Levinson, and the floor is all yours.
Well, I think you heard a very comprehensive
assessment of the role of the World Bank. I would like to raise a more basic issue, and that is the World Bank relevant any longer? And are the Millennium Development Goals relevant any longer? Are we in a completely different world? Because these institutions, as was so elegantly described and thoroughly described, were formed at a time when the assumption was that the borrowing member countries of the bank suffered from access to the capital markets, and therefore the World Bank, and then subsequently the regional development banks, were the intermediary, as, how do I pronounce your name?
Ruxandra.
All right, as Ruxandra described, why, since the countries could not directly go to the market, the private markets, the World Bank, using the subscribed capital of the industrialized countries, went and borrowed money in the private capital markets, and then unloaned that money to their borrowing member countries. Two things have happened. One, most of the middle income countries, what we call the emerging market countries, or however you want to call them, newly industrialized countries, there are all kinds of acronyms for describing them, now have direct access to the markets and are substantial borrowers in their own rights. Secondly, we have the issue, what is really almost, I think it's fair to say, we overuse the word revolutionary, but I think it's fair to say in this context, the change in the terms of trade. The commodity boom of the last decade, we don't know how long it's going to last, and we're seeing the turmoil in the financial markets, and we don't know how much it's going to spread, whether it's going to lead to a worldwide recession or depression, whatever you want to call it. But at least for the moment, or at least in the last 10 years, countries like Brazil, Argentina, Peru, in Latin America, countries in Africa, and in Asia, have been earning the largest trade surpluses in their history. Argentina and Brazil have paid off all of their borrowings from the IMF. The IMF now has only one major program, Turkey. The IMF isn't even receiving enough interest income to pay its current expenses, that is to say, salaries and other operating costs. It's had to sell gold because countries are financing themselves on the trade account. Argentina has the largest trade surpluses in its history. It told the IMF, thank you very much, we're not interested in your advice, go home. Brazil has paid off the IMF, and there are no longer any Brazilian IMF missions to Brazil. Peru is awash with funds. Their problem is, can they translate that funding which they're earning on their through their exports of capital of copper and other minerals into programs which reach down to the people so that they feel that this wealth is being translated into something which directly affects their lives. As a result, these two developments have changed the foundations on which the World Bank can operate. During the 80s and the 90s, we had the successive financial crises of the Latin America debt crisis, then we had Mexico, the peso crisis in 94, then we had the East Asian 97-98 financial crisis, then Russia, then Brazil. In all of these crises, the Bretton Woods institutions played a critical role. And they had a philosophy. The what we call neoclassical paradigm, I hate those fancy economic terms, but I don't know any better way to describe it, in which the emphasis was really
summarized in this famous or infamous, depending upon your point of view, Washington consensus, with its emphasis upon market allocation of resources, privatization of state-owned enterprises, diminished role for the government in formulating and promoting economic policy. Now, the distinctive feature of the last 10 years or so, or the beginning of this new century, is the collapse of that economic model as the model that the World Bank tried to promote in virtually all of its member countries, and that was then followed by the regional development banks under pressure from successive American administrations. There is now no single road to development. You now have countries like Venezuela and Bolivia in Latin America, which with a secure source of revenue through their oil exports, are following a completely different path. Bolivia has renationalized its oil and gas industry. Chavez and Evo Morales in Bolivia, the World Bank, in addressing poverty, wants countries to present a poverty reduction strategy paper as a precondition. Well, Chavez and Morales don't ask for any such papers. They just go ahead and are financing health clinics staffed by Cuban doctors and nurses, expanded primary education, adult literacy programs, and therefore, however much they are condemned for their macroeconomic policies and renationalization of natural resources, nevertheless, they have 60% approval ratings because they have reached the poorest people in their countries. Now, they are doing so in a way and with a program and a macroeconomic strategy which is completely alien to the World Bank and the IMF. You can agree or disagree, but the point is that this revolution in the trade account has opened up completely different, has opened up multiple strategies for development. The road that Argentina is following, it explicitly rejected IMF advice. In Brazil, you have a more market-friendly government of the left in the Lula administration. So, at least in Latin America, you have many roads to development. There is no single strategy any longer. Now, let me read you, I know it's a little bit difficult to follow, but I think it's worth reading you a little excerpts from an article by Larry Summers in the Financial Times, in which he says, "The qualitative surprise is this. With almost all the industrial world in or near recession, much of the momentum in the global economy is coming from countries with authoritarian governments that are pursuing economic strategies towards wealth accumulation and building up geopolitical strength rather than improving living standards for their populations. China, where household consumption has now fallen below 40% of its gross domestic product, which must be some kind of peacetime record, is the most extreme example." And he says, where we had, for all the disagreements over the past decades, there's been a shared premise behind international economic policy discussions. The goal of increased economic integration, the spread of market institutions, and more rapid growth for all nations. While companies may compete, the premise has been that nations cooperate to build a stronger economy in the interests of all. It is no longer clear that this premise remains valid. And he finally goes on to say that the world economy has been, global growth has depended on U.S. growth, which has depended on the U.S. consumer, and the U.S. consumer has depended on rising asset values, first of stocks and more recent of real estate. With falling house prices and a challenged financial system, U.S. consumer spending is falling. The U.S. is no longer in a position to be a net source of demand for the rest of the world. The question is, what, if anything, is going to substitute for this motor for growth? Now, what this means is that the ability of the U.S., both directly through its Millennium Challenge account which in the total scheme of things is a minor amount of money, and indirectly through the Bretton Woods institutions, is now unable to impose its vision of capitalist development along the lines of the U.S. Model, which is what they tried to do in Latin America in the 80s, and then in East Asia in the financial crises of the 90s. So what you have now is an intellectual vacuum with respect to development strategy. In one sense, it's let 100,000 flowers bloom. In another sense, you characterize it as anarchy. My view, for what it's worth, is that we now have different strategies which reflect different national histories and preferences. And that, in my view, is a healthy development. But it raises the question then, what is the role of these institutions? The IMF, without a single major program outside of Turkey, the World Bank with this poverty reduction priority, but really overtaken by individual countries following their own path like Venezuela and Bolivia, it's hard to see how the World Bank can impose any of its priorities. Take Chad in Africa. Now, the World Bank tried something, and I think it's fair to say, something noble. What they said is that with this resource boom, that let's try and assure that the resources are used for productive purposes and for the benefit of the vast majority in the countries. So they entered into an agreement with Chad whereby there would be a joint account signed off on by the World Bank and the Chadian authorities. I think they went too far because they located this account outside of Chad in London. But leave aside that kind of detail. The point was to assure that the oil resources were used for the benefit of the people and that you didn't have a repeat of Angola. We have tens of billions of dollars flowing into Angola, and the results for the majority of the population are dismal because it was siphoned off in corruption and who knows for what else. Now, the price of oil when this program was entered into from $20, as we all know, to $140, now it's in the 90s. And the Chadian government said, well, this is an unacceptable burden on our sovereignty. And they say they're surrounded by countries with civil war and they have security concerns and what have you. And so they wanted more flexibility in the use of the resources. And finally, last week or 2 weeks ago, the World Bank reported that they had ended their relationship with Chad. This attempt, which I think was well-intentioned and imaginative, to carve out a role for the World Bank in terms of channeling these resources from this revolution in commodity prices into productive purposes and for the benefit of the great majority of the people. It didn't happen, despite the best intentions of the World Bank. So what we are really left with at this point is, what is the role of these institutions when there is no agreed priority? There may be some formalistic agreements on the Millennium Challenge goals, but when you get down to the individual countries, they have very different priorities and very different strategies about how they're going to accomplish them. And in this world, therefore, where there is no single paradigm for development, which the World Bank tried to, and the IMF, the U.S. Treasury tried to impose during the 80s and the 90s, well then, what is the role of these institutions? Because the countries seemingly have both access to private financial markets directly, and on the trade account are earning these enormous trade surpluses, which give them the independence to follow whatever development path they choose. So I think that that's the fundamental issue, and as Summers points out, we may be confronted with even more fundamental issues. If the U.S. is forced to or abandons its role as the motor for international growth, and this leads to a slowdown in all of the emerging markets, which now appears to be happening, what then? Where do we go from there? And whether or not the World Bank, I personally believe that these institutions will still have a role to play, but they're going to have to give up this attempt to impose a single model of development.
Thank you very much, Professor Levinson. It's now my pleasure to introduce to you Professor T. Kumar. It took Professor T. Kumar one day to answer our call, but it was still amazing. Thank you very much for being here today. T. Kumar is the Advocacy Director for Asian Pacific at Amnesty International USA. He has worked in several Asian and African countries and served as a human rights monitor in Asia, as well as in Bosnia, Haiti, Guatemala, and South Africa. He has also served as director of several refugee ships and refugee camps. Mr. Kumar frequently lectures at the Foreign Service Institute and often testified before the U.S. Senate as well as before the House of Representatives. Mr. T. Kumar has served as UN United Nations Representative for Peace Brigades International and was a consultant to the Quaker United Nations Office. He holds an advanced law degree from the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Mr. Kumar was imprisoned for 5 years due to his peaceful human rights activities. While in prison, he started his legal studies and eventually became an attorney at law, and ever since then devoted his entire practice to defending political prisoners. So thank you very much for being here, and the floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is the first time I'm speaking about World Bank. That's not my field. That's not Amnesty International's field. So in my beginning, I want to say that my presentation is about my own analysis rather than Amnesty International's analysis, because we don't analyze more intensely about World Bank and its responsibilities. I have been asked to speak about civil and political rights versus economic and social rights in the context of Millennium Development Goals. So why don't I go first to the basics of human rights? What is human rights? What is the modern day, present day human rights came into existence? It's important to come to this area of Millennium Development Goals. As World Bank started immediately after the Second World War, human rights, present day human rights also started as a result of Second World War. 6 million Jews were killed for not what they did, because who they are, who they were, belonging to a particular ethnic or religious group. As a result, after the World War, victorious powers, not the powers that were defeated, by the way, they all got together and declared that we will never allow this to happen, never again, and atrocities of this nature will happen. That's the birth of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. So even though UDHR, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, have some economic and social rights aspects in the declaration, it's primarily a political declaration. So until in late 50s, there were two protocols that was brought in. One is economic and social rights protocol, as well as civil and political rights. That's a political rights issue, right to not to be imprisoned, tortured, etc. It was in the middle of the Cold War. So US and its allies championed the political rights. For them, human rights become political rights, not economic and social rights. Russia, China, and other socialist and left countries focused on economic and social rights. For them, economic and social rights become human rights. So for the US, imprisonment, torture, disappearance are all human rights. Not hunger, not poverty, not disease, or anything, right to health or right to education is not in their radar screen. For Russians and their Chinese and others, it is right to health, right to food, and other economic rights. Those that become the human rights, not torture or disappearances. So 1990, the Cold War came to an end. And immediately after that, they didn't plan it. UN had this UN Human Rights Conference in Geneva. In that, they emphasized that these two rights are interrelated, indispensable, universal. So ever since, both powers, Russia as well as US, agreed that these two sets of rights are interdependent, indispensable, and universal. Nothing is above the other. Nothing is inferior. Both are independent and interdependent. So let's go to what is Millennium Development Goals are. Millennium Development Goals basically are the reflection of economic and social rights. Stop or reduce poverty into whatever percentage by 2015. So it, in 2000, I think they declared that. So it's about 15-year timeline. It's a UN declaration. All the heads of states got together and like, let's do it. Reduce the poverty, reduce TB, HIV, all the good stuff. But it's all economic and social rights. The good thing was, even the US and other Western allies agreed to it in the name of human rights, by the way. Everyone knew it's part of human rights. So it's an achievement by itself to get that goal set by the UN. We can always analyze why economic and social rights or Millennium Challenge account is far more fundamental to human being. I am not arguing that the torture and disappearance are not less. By just simply thinking of a homeless child, homeless family in the street. The child is crying out of hunger. The father and mother are struggling how to feed the child. At that time, their responsibility and their heart cries out for food, not to freedom of expression or to freedom of press. So talking about political and civil rights in the absence of economic and social rights itself is cruel and demeaning to human beings. And human rights by the end of the day is human dignity. So I will argue that Millennium Development Goals are the best that have happened to the human rights improvements in the world. Now let's see where the World Bank can fit into that. You know, that's what the whole conference is all about. As I mentioned to you, I don't know World Bank, but I've just looked at it. Now you can see whether UN can do something. You can see an NGO or a government, US government can do something. But whether a financial institution which have, you know, development, financial institutions which are predominantly a development, you know, helping countries, can effectively champion these goals and achieve the results. First of all, I would like to say that we should all be happy that World Bank signed on to that. Without saying, no, our articles say we can't touch human rights. We are a financial institution. We don't want to get into this business. they signed on. That itself is a positive sign. But let's see whether that positive development can be translated, or what should be done to translate Millennium Development Goals into World Bank's activities and to make it real. Not 100%, even 50%. To do that, they have to transform themselves. I'm not an expert, I'm just telling from outside. Transform yourself. To advance political and civil rights, at least to my quick reading during the last day or two, the article specifically mentioned that you can't, when you give loans or credit assistance, make sure the political stability is there. So when there are massive human rights abuses are taking place in a particular country, there will not be political stability and World Bank may step aside. And there is also a danger of double punishment. When World Bank, it's US anyway. When, I do US policy, so naturally. When World Bank decided not to give because of human rights violations in a particular country, that country is being punished twice. First, the people of country, means I'm not talking about the government, obviously. We are talking about the citizens, the people who live in that particular country. So when they send, the people are suffering because of the government abuses, and World Bank is walking away because the government is abusing the citizens. That's a double punishment. One interesting thing you should note, all these double punishments will and have taken place in poorest of the poorest, weakest of the weakest countries in the world. World Bank will not have the guts to go after the Russians or Chinese. Only the little countries in the corner they will go after. So that itself, double punishment even in a on principle, should be objected. You walk out for different reasons, don't walk out for any other reasons. Okay, let's go to the Millennium Development Goals. Hunger. How are the World Bank trying to deal with this hunger? You know, it's a financial institution in development. So far they are trying, I presume, I'm bound to be corrected, by integrating and setting up some goals in the countries they have operations. I'm not talking about the staff. I'm talking about the policy is pretty much guiding towards that. I will say the fundamental problem for the World Bank to be an effective partner in the Millennium Development Goal is the governance issue. Who governs World Bank determines how its policies are being championed. By law of the World Bank, US is always the president. Citizen of the US is always the president. A man is always the president. By the way, I don't know whether the US have ever appointed a woman there. Discrimination starts from the beginning. IMF, I think it's European countries. So we are talking about industrialized, or in a very crude form I can say, Western countries. Basically got together and controlled these institutions, the financial institutions. The boss decides everything, the World Bank, president. We had some excellent characters like Wolfowitz sitting there at one point. Imagine Wolfowitz. It's a public knowledge, he's the architect of the Iraq War. Talking about human rights, That says it all. That says it all. There should be a vetting process inside, not outside. He stepped out because of the outside pressure. Then leave the World Bank president power. The power of the Board of Governors who make the decisions is also unfairly biased. They can argue it's a financial institution, so we need people who contribute have the share. That's fine. If that's the case, don't talk about human rights. Keep away. Tell us, and we are financial institution, hands off. But don't mix human rights into your mix, because by doing that, you are hurting human rights, not helping. It may, for the short term, it may look good, but in the long term, it will hurt human rights as principle and as implementing process. United States controls 20% of the voting rights. 47 countries of sub-Saharan Africa have only 7% voting rights. So, president is there, he's a US citizen. 20% of US share, US determines the direction of the bank. And other Western allies, they basically determine what's happening in sub-Saharan Africa, Asia and Latin America. It's like, here I am, rich man, here I'm trying to tell you what to do, how to do. That's the defect we are seeing. It's better World Bank revise itself to rotate its presidency and find some other means of decision-making process. If you think this process should be there, then as I advised earlier, step away from human rights and million development goals. Leave it to others who are genuine and sincere. There is also a question whether the World Bank is being used as a tool for the US foreign policy. The latest example is IMF. Yesterday it was reported IMF is rushing to give some 50 billion or 50 million, I don't know how much, to Georgia. Overnight, Georgia became an important country to IMF. That raises the question of impartiality. So, the question of governance is fundamental for an institution. Any institution, in this case, World Bank institution, to be more active and be more effective in promoting human rights, and bringing and achieving the Millennium Development Goals. In closing, I would like to say, as I mentioned to you, it's the first time I'm talking about World Bank. But I am happy that I was invited, because now I am going to look more intensely to see how we can push the World Bank in the right direction. By the end of the day, it could be World Bank, it could be us, it could be anyone. When we talk about human rights, our responsibility lies to the homeless child who is crying out of hunger. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Latif Kumar. Now we have a Q&A session. We have a wireless microphone. So anybody feel free to take a stand and ask the question. We've heard three very distinctive opinions.
Where are the other questions there? Two questions. Oh. We just ask you to introduce yourself and you can set up some people. Okay.
I am a JD student at WCL. So I think credit is like a beautiful thing. I think that's why many of us are actually in this room, because we have credit to come to WCL. But as far as alleviating world poverty, I feel there's like some sort of disconnect when there's a transaction between two states. So I think if we're trying to alleviate world poverty, maybe I'm just being a little bit ignorant or oversimplifying the situation, but then isn't there something about if we're trying to alleviate socioeconomic classes of the poorest of the poor, why aren't we dealing with the poorest of the poor? I mean, I think I'm just taking this example from the Grameen Bank, which is started by Mohammed Yunus in Bangladesh, where small loans were given to people who had absolutely nothing. But then with that, they were able to work up maybe just a little bit, even if the loan is $10, they were able to start something, work up. So then I was just like thinking that, taking that in mind while I was listening to the presentation, where we have these transactions between one big entity and a state, but then how does that trickle down? I mean, is there a new model that we could create where perhaps we don't deal with states, but we deal with people? I don't know. I'm not an economist.
Can I ask you, this is a question for Ruxander.
Actually both of you, because okay. You mentioned that there are, we should be open to new ideas of development, and then also, because you are from the World Bank, it's open to you as well. Thank you.
Wants to take a crack on it first?
Well, the development banks, both the IDB and the World Bank and the Asian Development Banks, have all been financing the type of programs that you're talking about, the micro loans of Bangladesh. What I was referring to is that there's also what Chavez and Morales and I forget what his name is in Ecuador have been doing, which doesn't rely upon international finance, because they're earning large sums through oil. What's different about these governments is they're actually trying to put them to work in programs that reach exactly the levels that you're talking about. And as a result, as I say, we may not like Chavez. His rhetoric is obnoxious and so forth and so on. But the fact of the matter is that the oil revenues are reaching down to people. The New York Times has reported about how consumption is widely spread now in Venezuela instead of being limited to a small elite. Morales has, in Bolivia, the adult literacy program in Bolivia is the most aggressive since Fidel Castro in Cuba in 59. So these things are happening. The point is that they're happening within countries which have adopted strategies of development which would not necessarily have been endorsed by the World Bank in the 80s and the 90s. The world has opened up intellectually and strategically because of the change, for example, in the trade regime. This has given countries the freedom to follow different paths. Argentina could never do what it has done if the trade regime hadn't changed in its favor. They're exporting all the grains they can produce. The issue is not access to markets. The issue is how much they can produce. That's a fundamental change.
Well, a couple of things. First, the World Bank is not the IMF, and the IMF is not the World Bank, and there are differences. And I think my presentation might have been good to make a clear distinction between the two institutions. One issue that comes to mind is that IMF, when it presents itself, is that it lends money both to poor and rich countries. It is meant to provide relief on an emergency basis, while World Bank is lending to poor countries and it has long-term development objectives. I speak here in my capacity as a World Bank staff, and going back to your question, although from a legal perspective, the legal agreement and the loan or the credit is being signed with a sovereign, and we are again like a corporation and with the shareholders, and we do business with those member countries, we always have in mind that it ultimately it's for the beneficiaries are the people and the most poor. But by the most poor, I mean in the comprehensive development strategy, you do not necessarily need to go in the slums of Brazil or Venezuela, and by reducing their levels of poverty, you can be happy that you have achieved development. Poverty and inequality has many different faces. And for example, when you tackle the gender issues, it's at any different level in the society. When you tackle efficiency in the government, transparency, it has direct implications on the development agenda of a country, but your audience is a little bit different. And taking the government out of this equation, I think from a legal perspective, it can never be done, but on a day-by-day implementation, if you wish, perspective, the implementation of the project, you know, it is about working with those people that matter most. And another point that I want to make, I might be jumping from one idea to another, so it doesn't flow. The World Bank in middle-income countries, Professor Levinson, has been reinventing itself. And I totally believe that the question you're putting on the table, are we relevant today, is very valid. I think we are trying to be relevant. I think we have continuously evolved so that we continue to be relevant. And we are changing the way we are doing business. Today, in big countries like China or India or Brazil, we are working at state level. I have been part of a project in Brazil, in the state of Ceará, when the federal government could no longer lend money to that state, who is actually one of the most poor states in Brazil. They suggested that they work with the World Bank. So we had a loan that helped in different sectors, from health to education, environment, in infrastructure. And we are working with middle-income countries that indeed have access to capital markets, but they come to the World Bank not necessarily in order to secure funding, but they might come to the World Bank to secure knowledge, expertise, world-class expertise, to share experiences and best practice across the world, across the countries. And also the World Bank, I think, is very relevant in today's world, because it's using its power of convener, of getting people together to speak to one another. When the annual meetings 2 years ago, we heard from the NGOs that they couldn't get through to speak with the government, we sat down at the table and we invited both parties, and we opened the channels of communication. As well, the World Bank, I think, it has a very important role of convener in the developing, with the development partners, with the other lenders, and with the other regional developing development institutions, and ultimately with all the stakeholders, from the civil societies, with the NGOs, with the media, and so on. So I hope this brings a little bit clarity to your question.
Do we have any other question? Just raise your hand. Michael?
Many questions.
I probably want your microphone.
You were just asking.
I have two questions. You don't have to answer them both if you don't want it. So I haven't heard anything about with high commodity prices, what's the effect of extractive industries transparency initiative and the EITI plus, which came out, or plus plus. What does that mean and how is it going to be implemented? The other thing is with the Millennium Development Goals, I'm just worried it's a little it's a step backward from if these countries had signed covenants on economic, social, and cultural rights already, then these countries should be committed to those goals. And the World Bank should be focused on helping those countries achieve those goals, not half of the poverty. Which half are you talking about? I just see a lot of problems with that. And I know it's just an arbitrary goal they created to try to reach something, but I'm just worried it's dangerous, because if we don't meet the goals,
then maybe people will say, well, we should give up. And if we do meet the goals, people will say, maybe we should stop, we did it. So how do you address that?
Is a question for Professor Levinson or for...
For anyone who would like to address you with the question.
Well, with respect to the second question, the question of targets, I think it was, I don't fault them for the target of halving. I think it was an assessment of what could realistically be achieved. Now, as Alexander pointed out, you know, a great deal of the achievement has been accomplished through China and India, two very different development approaches. India through a democratic government with a country with 160 different dialects, but nevertheless, since independence, nobody can fault the integrity of the elections and the independent judiciary, etc. China, a very different strategy. One party authoritarian government. You don't have any independent trade unions, although they made some recent steps to strengthen the role of our workers in collective bargaining. So now both of them have made extraordinary progress in reducing poverty, absolute poverty, in the face of tremendous odds. The caste system in India, you're managing a country of over a billion people in China. So I don't fault what you might well describe as the modesty of the goal, but I don't share your concern that will take away from the ultimate goal of really eliminating poverty. So as far as that goes, now your first question, could you just summarize?
I was just wondering, I didn't hear anything about the Extractive Industry Transparency Initiative, and it just seems...
Well, I refer to, in the extractive industries, you saw the World Bank attempt something with Chad. I mean, they really did attempt to assure that the resources were used for the benefit of the people. It found it, as I say. I mean, you know, my feeling is they went too far and taking the money offshore, but I don't think that would have been decisive. The fact of the matter is that when the price of oil went to $120, $140, Chad decided they didn't need the World Bank imprimatur anymore, and frankly, when they got free of the World Bank, the first thing they did was buy a luxury aircraft for the president of the country. Well, there isn't much the World Bank can do about that. However, they did make an attempt to avoid what happened in Angola, where tens of billions of dollars were earned through the oil, the extractive industries, and very little to show for it in terms of benefits for the country as a whole. So I don't, I think what we're, this is also part of the World Bank trying to carve out a role for itself. The Chinese go into Africa. If the country has minerals or something, the Chinese will build the mine. They'll build the railroad. They'll build the port to get it all out. But they're interested in the resource for their economy. They don't ask about, you know, what's your fiscal policy? What's your are you spending enough on human resources? They don't ask about corruption, and they bring their own people to build things. So what capacity are they leaving in Africa? And this is leading to a reaction of sorts. Well, more recently, the Chinese seem to have approached the World Bank about entering into some joint projects to take some of the edge off of the strategy they've been following, to make it more acceptable. So this is part of what I think was referring to when she said the World Bank is trying to reinvent itself to be more relevant in the distinct purposes. China's been severely criticized for going it alone, but China is trying to become a member of the Inter-American Development Bank and of the Asian Development Bank. It became a member of the WTO. So China seems to be wanting to integrate itself into the international system and groping for some collaboration with the World Bank. Now, you know, how much further the World Bank can go to assure transparency? I think you saw some of the limitations in the Chadian experience, but you also see some promising initiatives with the Chinese looking for some form of collaboration with the World Bank.
Do you think there could be some national, domestic pressure politically or regional pressure with countries who sign on? If with Nigeria, they put it in the paper, the next day everyone was reading the paper, trying to figure out what the government was getting. And it seems like the pressure would come internally.
But look at what's happening in Nigeria. Excuse me, I'll finish with this comment.
Actually, we have only just a few minutes, so maybe one more quick question answer.
I think the lady just...
Okay,
just next to you on your left.
Hi, my name is Bridget Basile. I'm with the International Communications Program at SIS. I just wanted to say thank you for your comments today. And this question is directly first to you, Ms. Wodisco. In terms of, you mentioned in your presentation the idea of being inclusive, I think you're referring to in the governance piece of the World Bank. And I was wondering if you could tell us more about what you mean by it.
Okay, first, just very brief comments to the questions that were raised before. On EITI, if you are interested in this subject, we can continue the discussion after this session. It fascinates me. I think it's absolutely important. There are a lot of the dollar amount, it's fantastic. If we can put those funds to work for the development agenda in comparison to what the dollar amounts the World Bank can put on the table, there is no comparison. So a country needs to help itself. And we are very proud. I'm now working in Africa region. Our vice president is a champion of the EITI agenda in Nigeria. So the institution, as you said, is developing the EITI plus agenda and is moving forward with support. But a lot of times we need, not a lot of times, all the time, we need the countries to come on board. We need the countries to feel the same about the EITI agenda or any other agenda. So progress and results so far have been mixed. Some countries are very advanced, some countries not as much, and Professor Levinson also attached to that. So we can discuss more about the MDGs. I think the targets are there, and when they were set, it was well thought, they were well thought of, and they were considered realistic, and it was something that could be done. If it's not going to be done, it's a lesson for us to look at why we have failed to comply with them. And it doesn't mean that we would give up. It would mean that probably going forward, 2015 onwards, we would have to understand where we failed and why and what we should do differently. And reducing poverty by 50%, I think it should be quite impressive. So maybe you can argue with we should reduce it by 90% by 2015. Maybe that was considered unrealistic. Back to your question, the doctrine of all inclusiveness admits that there are many stakeholders, and a development strategy has to include everybody. So at the time of a project is put together, and this is something also that I would like to mention with you. Very often we talk about World Bank loans, World Bank credits, but it's actually they are not World Bank loans. These are World Bank supported country loans. So the project belongs to the country and to the people in that country. And the World Bank provides technical expertise and finances but the vision is shared, or is the countries? Maybe Professor Levinson has something to say about that, but I strongly believe in this approach. And at the time of project preparation, I'm an operational person. I don't come from legal department. My job is to put projects together all the time and to go and speak with the government of what their strategies are, what their needs are, and how can World Bank support them. And when we put together the projects, we usually do a lot of consultations, and we try to identify everybody that could be concerned and what everybody thinks about this, and take into consideration all the different approaches. Then we try to build a partnership with the other donors in line with the Paris Declaration on Donor Harmonization, and we try to see whether private sector can come in, and it's something that the private sector would be interested in financing in the first place. And only after everybody has had a chance to contribute do we really set the goals and the project and the design and we move forward.
Okay, we have time for one more question.
I'm Margaret Farrell. I'm an adjunct professor here. Taking into account the comments of Professor Levinson and the person from Amnesty, the question is to the World Bank representative, is there any serious thought in giving the World Bank about reforming its governance and its mission? Is there, as with the UN, there was a lot of discussion within the UN about how to reform its governance and its function. Is that kind of consideration being given within the bank to these issues that were raised here today?
I'm afraid I cannot really comment on that. But to try to give you some kind of an answer. Okay, we have coffees and we have brown bag lunches and we sometimes have a drink, and between ourselves we discuss this all the time. The World Bank staff at the present, in percentage of 55%, we are coming from, me included, we are coming from developing countries. Of course, the issues of governance would often come up in our discussions over a beer or over a glass of wine. Whether the board is looking at revising the governance structure, I have no idea. Whether it is going to happen again, I have no idea. Whether it should happen, I cannot really comment on. But the thing is that I want to tell you, and you might believe me or not, in my work every day, from the day I arrive in my office and until the day I leave, and on all my missions, and I'm traveling to Beirut Saturday to meet with the representatives of the Iraq government. We are providing support to them to improve their financial management systems. And I've been recently to Bulgaria and Croatia providing strengthening to their judicial systems. And I'm working mainly on Africa and on region integration projects. In my everyday life at the bank and in my dialogues with the government, representatives, the nationality of my president, of the president of the World Bank, for me it's not an issue. I listen to what my client is saying, and we truly believe that the client should be in the driver's seat. And when we meet with them, we listen very carefully, we do our homework, we think hard of how we can assist them, and we put projects together. I know this is very sexy to think about all these sort of issues, and I think the discussion has its merits. But when every day we get our hands dirty and we go and we try to do development and put a development agenda at work, I don't think whether President Zoric is from United States or from Romania or from Argentina.
Just to supplement what you said, there has been a very lively debate over the informal understanding at the time these institutions were organized was that the president of the World Bank would be an American national, and the managing director of the IMF would be a European. Now, in the recent transitions, that assumption has been challenged. Now, it may not affect the way in which you operate, but it's the political level of these institutions is a very charged debate. Now, the other thing is whether you're going to give China more and India and Brazil and South Africa more representation in the decision-making. Stiglitz has raised the issue of, in the negotiations, it's usually more with respect to the IMF than with the World Bank, that the finance ministers negotiate with the country team, what have you. He says, why shouldn't the Secretary of Labor be at the table when labor issues are at issue, as they are inevitably in the discussion of the macroeconomic? So the question of governance is both at the political level and also at the philosophical level of the economic. I once had a conversation with a high-level official of the IMF, and I was raising the question of the neoclassical economic model that they follow. And he said, that's the only model we in the World Bank have. Well, I think that world is now over. And as Virga indicated, they're much more open now. I don't think they have now an overarching economic model, and it's still very controversial. For example, the World Bank puts out a publication about, rating countries according to whether they're open to more welcoming of investment and business. And in that rating, they rate
the doing business report.
Right, the doing business report. And in that report, they rate countries which have strong labor protections right at the bottom as not friendly to business. Well, this has enraged people on the Hill. And it's going to become a big issue in the next replenishment negotiations of the IDA. So the question of governance, it's one thing at the level at which she's operating, but there are very fundamental questions about the philosophy which the World Bank has brought, the degree to which it seeks to impose that philosophy through these conditions, like weakening labor protections. And this is in this country, in the U.S. Congress, and if you ever get a Democratic administration, this is going to be a highly charged issue with the World Bank.
So I think on that note, we can slowly close the event. We ran out of time. We'd like to thank Professor Levinson, Alexandra, and T. Kumar for coming, the Academy, Raquel, Claudia, and everybody else for support. And then the International Week is still ongoing, so
good luck.
Thank you.
Nice meeting.
Alexandra, we have a little present for you for coming today.
Sorry?
Professor.